This is University Forum. I'm Jean Moore, bringing you conversations with outstanding personalities on issues of interest to local, national, and international communities. Our topic today, the artistic and creative life of Jack Waters and Peter Kramer. By telephone to New York, this is the first of a two-part program exploring some of the myriad of artistic and activist pursuits in which both of my very talented guests have been involved locally, nationally, and on an international level for some 20 years. I welcome to University Forum first, Jack Waters, a graduate of the Juilliard's Dance Division, is a filmmaker, writer, media artist, choreographer, and performer, and also was an assistant professor at Hampshire College. Welcome, Jack.
Hello. How are you, Jean?
Well, I'm delighted to have you, Jack, and now I want to welcome your lifetime partner, Peter Kramer, multidisciplinary artist in dance, performance, film, video, photography, as well as curator and administrator, and he is included in the archives collection of Museum of Modern Art, among other prestigious venues. Welcome to University Forum, Peter.
Thank you very much, Jean. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, both of my guests, both of you, have individually and jointly received such extensive recognition for your film and other media that I hardly know where to start as I looked over some of the background information you shared with me. But, Jack, let me first thank you for agreeing to take time, because I know you're very busy up there, and arranging this interview, not just for you, but for Peter. And I want to know, Peter, you both were riding bicycles when we finalized most of these arrangements. Where in New York do you ride bicycles?
I ride it everywhere. It's my major source of transportation here in the city.
Uh-huh.
There's not too many places that I can't go on a bicycle.
Well, I was up there not too long ago, and there seemed to be quite a few cars competing with any bicycles.
Right. Lately, it seems like it's been getting a bit more aggressive. There's been this ongoing sort of struggle with the police department ever since the Republican National Convention here. They've been cracking down on the... There's a monthly ride that happens that's done through critical mass where hundreds of bicycle riders take to the street and essentially, show the number of riders and people that are interested in alternative forms of transportation.
Oh, that's very interesting.
So I don't know whether some of that anger or whatever is boiling down to regular riders, but I've, just as recently have had a few, run-ins with irate motorists.
Well, the taxi cabs still are strong and heavy and fast, and I don't envy trying to get through some of that. Now, there's a lot of times when people are actually couriers going through the streets, and they come and go around quite rapidly, too.
Well, in fact, New York is a bike town. There are fairly recently, but certainly within the last 5 or 10 years, there are bike lanes that are designated specifically for bicycles, and motorists don't honor them all the time as bike lanes, and there's certainly not as many as I would like to have, but they are there, and they are supposed to be used for bicycles, as well as the bicycle lock places they've set up all around the city, where instead of having to hitch to poles when you lock your bicycle, you can do that. But as Peter says, since Critical Mass made a show of force after the Republican National Convention here in New York City, there has been something of a war against bicycles.
Hmm. Well, we have bicycle lanes here in Philadelphia now, too, and it seems to be all over the country that there is a use of alternative means. But Jack, let me get right to something related to the mission statement I saw in your materials about your company, the Allied Productions Incorporated.
Okay.
What is that company, and how did you both get started in it?
Well, we're an umbrella organization, which means that we can have both incorporated entities under our auspices, as well as unincorporated groups and individuals. And we are dedicated towards fostering and developing interests in the arts for the general public. And the way that we do this is by services to artists. by showing them ways to present and produce their work, as well as showing them resources, both funding and material, as ways for them to make their artwork so that that can be presented to the general public.
Hmm. Now, something in that mission statement that you shared with me speaks to the importance of cross-cultural activities with multicultural themes of gentrified communities and colonized communities, as I remember the wording on it. Peter, how does that play out in reality? What happens there as far as that that part of the mission?
Well, what it is, it really just kind of identifies and, you know, either seeks to investigate and sort of elucidate what all of those forces mean and how they affect neighborhoods and the displacement and the escalation of rents and that type of thing when there are the syndrome of, you know, people that are, you know, kind of on the outskirts or, you know, the economic levels and they're in underdeveloped communities when they've gone in there to pioneer and to stick around and to create lives for themselves, they suddenly find themselves surrounded by real estate interests that are, you know, pushing them out in a way. I mean, everything becomes a more unaffordable, and everything gets a little more upgraded and upscale, and it loses the neighborhoods. You know, try to absorb and evolve, but sometimes, if depending on, you know, how large the development is, it can really just change the characters of neighborhoods, you know, overnight.
Yes. So what we do as an arts organization is create programs. For example, last fall we had two artists come from Berlin, Germany, and they put together a performance as well as two sculptures that they shipped here, these huge metal sculptures. And those two sculptures were what they called a trans family. And trans meaning people who identify as transgendered people. And the trans family was seen as one of the marginalized communities that we present and support in our cultural activities. So Mike and Toby, the two German artists, did some investigation with the gentrification issues in San Francisco. The whole history of how the rents were changed and how the community participated in confronting and addressing the gentrification and escalation of unaffordable housing in San Francisco, and compared it to what's happening in Europe as well as what's happening in New York City.
Now, does this take on art forms and art presentations and some kind of choreographed work that goes both on the artistic level as well as the day-to-day concerns of what happens as a neighborhood and area becomes gentrified and moves out of the grasp of people who had originally lived there?
Well, that particular performance spoke directly to it. It was called Parallel Worlds, and how, you know, you have these two economic and social forces that are sort of passing each other constantly. You know, either, and there are maybe a few moments in everyone's daily lives where those paths are crossing, and what kind of interaction can happen, and the tricky thing is finding those spaces where they can actually happen. Some of them are public spaces, some of them are private spaces, but for us, the garden is that location, that place where we're experiencing both people that are coming and going from the neighborhood and visitors or people that are just arriving. And so we are hoping within the context of the garden and through the use of the art medium as a tool to begin some sort of a interaction.
Talk about the garden as such. Is it a garden? What is in that garden, and how does it compare with some of the neighborhood gardens that talk about planting vegetables and foodstuffs? What is the garden as you have it now?
The garden is a Green Thumb Garden, which is a New York City program to beautify empty city lots. It's called Petit Versailles, after the great estate of Louis XIV of France. And in that regard, it means that it has a formal design and that they're not really individual plots, which are more indicative of a lot of other community gardens throughout New York City. And within the garden, we really aren't able to grow a lot of things in terms of vegetables because, first of all, we have a very limited space. And also, we feel we're very close to a major thoroughfare, which is Houston Street. And so just the concern about air pollution and that type of thing. Mm-hmm. So it's really more of an oasis of suddenly you're walking off the sidewalk and you're suddenly immersed in this total green space, which is very intimate and has lots of little byways. And so you can stand in the middle of the space and take it all in, but then you can sort of diverge and find spaces where you can be more solitary. And that, you know, is a helpful thing for a lot of people when they're, you know, stressed out during their daily lives to have someplace that's available.
Quite different than going into Central Park, which is a vaster and far less intimate arrangement there.
Well, it's smaller, but it's more dense. For example, we have two large mulberry trees, and this afternoon or this morning, the first thing that I did before doing my yoga session was to sweep some of the mulberries that had dropped onto the deck that we use as a performance area. And I noticed that when I came into the garden, Peter was also sweeping off mulberries. Mulberries is an indigenous plant to New York City and I believe all of the East Coast. Then we also have several varieties of roses. We have hydrangeas. We've got one of the first things that we planted were periwinkles, which are ground covering, and all sorts of vines. We've got lots of ivy. So as Peter said, it is a very thick and green space, but it's tiny. It takes up about the size of a building, because that's what stood there before we planted it, was a building that had been abandoned and then torched and then demolished.
Now, what part of New York are we talking about when you say a building? Because I think of the different areas around the city. I grew up in New York City, and I just kept trying to get a sense of where this could be.
Well, this is located in the East Village, on the south end of the East Village, on the border of what's known as the Lower East Side, mm-hmm. which Houston kind of demarcates the difference between those two neighborhoods. And we're closer to Avenue C, so if you can imagine, I don't know if you remember the Hamilton Fish swimming pool, but that's the neighborhood that we're in. So we're at the edge of some large housing projects and also the new development that's coming in from the west along Houston Street from 2nd Avenue towards Essex Street. There are a lot of brand new towering buildings that are more than, 10 or 15 mm-hmm. feet tall. And that's part of that whole
influx. I mean, the 10 or 15, are you saying the 10 or 15 stories or 10 or 50?
10 or 15 stories high.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and they're mostly luxury mm-hmm. Buildings that are going up in the neighborhood.
Have you had a good response and involvement of the community in the garden?
We have many different communities. We have a community that has been in the neighborhood for many generations. There's a Latino community. There is an African-American contingent within that demographic. And then we also border Chinatown and Little Italy. But then we also have what is really an artist community. And, of course, artists span race and nationality. And so the Lower East Side has always been a refuge for artists because it has, up until very recently, been very cheap, an inexpensive place to live. So we do have a response. Our main response is from what I consider the artist community. But then we also have our local community. For example, all of the roses from our rose garden come from our neighbor, Maria Orama, who passed away about 2 Augusts ago. But she would get roses from mail order company, grow them, get them started on her fire escape, and then bring them down as little shrubs to us, and then we'd plant them into the garden. So that's the kind of response that we get from our various communities.
You're listening to University Forum with my guests, Jack Waters and Peter Kramer, skilled and talented artistic performance and creators with a strong vent for policy issues affecting communities. Jack, how did you get involved in the media as a producer? Because you produce a number of things.
Well, I do. I started my formal training as an artist, as a dancer and choreographer. And because I was always very interested in dance as a creative form as opposed to an interpretive form, I started to organize very early. I started to learn that in order to choreograph, you had to bring people together, which means that you have to deal with scheduling, and you have to deal with all of the things that are involved with organizing. And also, in order to leave a record of the dance and choreography, you have to somehow make some kind of a moving image record. So I began to learn how to videotape early on, and videotaping was my way of recording dance. And gradually, I started addressing video and film independently as arts within themselves.
Was it difficult for you to get your work exhibited?
Well, it is difficult. It continues to be difficult in some cases, especially in the mainstream sense, although I have exhibited. I've exhibited at the Whitney Museum of American Art once, and I've also exhibited all around the world at various institutions, but most of our work is presented independently, and this is another function of Allied Productions, and one of the reasons that we formed it is because we knew that the type of work that we were creating, we would have to present ourselves.
Hmm. Well, you mentioned something about the New York Lesbian and Gay Experimental Film Festival, also known as MIX. Would you explain what that is?
Yeah, MIX, as you said, started out as the New York Lesbian and Gay Experimental Film Festival. It was started as a response to mainstream commercial media and recognized that there has been a long, long history of film, video, and other types of moving image art that stands outside of the commercial realm. And what the two organizers, Sarah Schulman and Jim Hubbard, discovered was that a lot of these experimental filmmakers also had gay and lesbian, or what we call now queer, identities, where they may not have expressed it politically, but in their individual and social lives, they were gay, lesbian, and alternative sexually identified. And when you look at the work, you realize that the work itself reflects who they are. So for many years, the Experimental Lesbian and Gay Film Festival was the only lesbian and gay film festival in New York City. And now there is another one called the New Festival, which is more feature film oriented. But the MIX Festival focuses primarily on short films and short videos, and now has started to look at other forms of media, including live art or performance.
What is No Rio?
Well, I'll take that question.
Peter?
The ABC No Rio is there was a sign across from the building that said Abogado Notorio, which is lawyer. And that sign had been, you know, weathered, and what you could read was something that resembled ABC No Rio. But ABC No Rio is a 25-year-old arts space on the Lower East Side on Rivington Street that developed out of an action by a group called Collaborative Projects. They took over a building on Delancey Street, put in an art show, highlighting the use of the fact that there were all these empty buildings in the neighborhood that weren't being used for anything, put in an art show, which the city promptly shut down. And within the ensuing publicity and dialogue with the city, they were offered the building on Rivington Street, where they've been ever since.
Mm.
So it's a community center. Now, actually, just recently, this past spring, the building was finally transferred to Abecino Rio from the city, and now they occupy the whole building, but they also are now responsible for renovating it because it's, you know, as we were there, there were always problems with, you know, the condition of the building. And so they now have that responsibility to take on. So their programs will be continuing, but I think they'll be doing some things, you know, off-site, and how the other collaborators that they have at the space, they have a computer lab and a dark room and a silk screen press, and Food Not Bombs operates out of there. So it will be, you know, a transition period for everyone to try and continue programming while these renovations are going on.
Was the city easy to be persuaded to give the building over?
Well, I think the fact that there have been, I think, four major generations of people that have, you know, continued this struggle to maintain the building and do the programming and exhibit, you know, the kind of socially aware art projects that are, you know, a hallmark of Abecino Rio and their founding organization.
As Peter said, Abecino Rio has always identified as a community space, but it's always expressed its social and political philosophy through the arts. And as he also said, it was generated from a political action called the Real Estate Show that was started by a group called CoLab, or Collaborative Projects Incorporated, in the early 80s. And Peter and I inherited it from CoLab, and Peter and our group of people, our posse, if you will, started to run Abecino Rio in conjunction with some of the founding artists of CoLab. And so what we have managed to do is to keep a continuity so that these like-minded generations of socially aware artists have a continuum that that really mainly keep the flame of the original ideals of Abecino Rio burning. But as far as the struggle, for many years, since Abecino Rio was started from an action that protested the lack of use of available space for housing, for elderly care, for child care, and of course for arts purposes, the city of New York was always very reluctant to let Abecino Rio keep its building. The building where Abecino Rio is located was actually a concession made to those artists, because the real estate that they had begun to squat on Delancey Street was deemed too valuable. And so for the years that Peter and I were the formal directors of Abecino Rio, a lot of the work that we were doing, aside from maintaining programming and activities, was just making sure that, first of all, the roof stayed intact, because the city, who was the formal owner, was doing little or no maintenance. And then because a lot of the money and income that we were generating was coming into the maintenance, that the city, we basically went on rent strike. And so we were constantly fending off eviction notices from the city. So really, for many decades, from, I guess, 1983 until very recently, a lot of the work was in just keeping the building, both physically and keeping the city from moving the artists out. And as Peter said, finally, just in the last year or so, the city finally gave Abecino Rio the building with the provision that the entire building be used for public use, and that Abecino Rio put all of its effort into physically bolstering and maintaining the physical plant of the building.
We've not talked yet about the problem of AIDS and possibly the impact on the gay community. And next for our next show, we're going to expand our discussion on it. But before we wind down in our program today, I note, Jack, you worked for 6 months as a marketing manager for a prescription service. If I understand correctly, the clientele base were AIDS and HIV positive people.
Yes, I did. I worked for many years of the prescription service called CPS. And CPS was a sister organization for a magazine called PAWS. And PAWS's purpose was to provide information for treatment and for medication for people with AIDS. And CPS was a mail order pharmacy where people who lived in places where it was too socially restrictive to just go to the pharmacy, like a small town America, you could have your AIDS medications delivered to you. So my job, my formal title was marketing manager for CPS. And what I did was make sure that PAWS magazine was available to the people who came to find out about the various treatment options for the physicians and researchers who I would organize to come to speak from town to town across the United States.
What has happened to that service since you left that position?
Well, because the epidemic has changed, in the early days of the epidemic, there was little or no treatment, and especially nothing that didn't come out of a direct and aggressive political demand through groups like ACT UP. And as expanded access and experimental and now treatments that are on the market have become available and have proved effective, there has become less and less of a need for services like CPS. Also, because AIDS and HIV status is not such a stigma. If you'll remember, the word AIDS was not even pronounced by then-President Reagan until, I believe, 1990 or sometime during the end of his last term of office. And now that it's not such a stigma, there's less of a need for these kinds of mail order services in terms of having to avoid stigma. And also the epidemic itself has changed. There's less experimentation taking place because a lot of the treatments are effective, which is not to say that there are not side effects and not to say that people are not still affected by AIDS, and certainly not to say that there is not a great need for education. So PAWS magazine is still in existence, but as far as I know, CPS is no longer operative.
As we talk about some of the changes that have taken place in terms of both the treatment and the impact of the disease, we're going to really spend some more time in our second show to explore a little bit more and to give some of the background information for our listeners. Before we end today, let me take you back just for a minute or two then in terms of one more project that you had. And the Yaddo Art Colony, we have about 30 seconds. Tell me, what is that about?
Yaddo is an artist, a writer's colony in upstate New York in Saratoga Springs. It's the result of the family that lost their children in tragic circumstances, and then when they died, they bequeathed the estate to continue as a writer's colony. And in 2001, in November of 2001, we were guests of Yaddo, and we were able to spend a month up there doing whatever it is that we wanted to work on.
I want to thank you so much for this first part of a two-part program. And next week's show, we will continue our discussion about the creative and productive lives of my guests, Jack Waters and Peter Kramer. And I want to thank both of you for this first part of our conversation. Thank you, Jack.
Well, thank you very much.
And thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Gene, very much. We'll look forward to speaking further.
I'm Gene Moore.
host and executive producer of University Forum. Please send your comments or questions on University Forum programs to me by email, jemore@wrti.org, or call my voicemail, 215-204-4376.